During this hour this week, we are looking at some of the major forms of piety that are very evident in the American Protestant Church today, but which had a genesis that goes back at least to the 19th century. The two that we've looked at so far have a rather positive relationship to the culture. On the one hand, we've taken a look at the Gospel of Wealth, which suggested from those who propounded it to be a Christian point of view as to the acquisition and distribution of wealth. Yesterday, we looked at the social gospel, which likewise was a relationship to culture, which sought to suggest ways in which religion, based on following the example of Jesus, as with Charles Sheldon and his novel In His Steps, could be utilized in a very practical way then in establishing the kingdom of God on earth. This morning, we take a different direction, a point of view that is essentially seeking to avoid culture. And so what we'll be looking at this hour really stands far apart from what we were doing the first 2 hours this morning, and looking at the prophet Amos, and then looking at the questions of economic order and justice. Because revivalism tends to suggest, and as a historian, I can always get out of corners if I use the word tend. I learned this very early in graduate school, that whenever you say something about a movement, say it's tending toward, and that way you do not get boxed in. And so there are other kinds of qualifiers, but that's a good one for me, to use the term tendency. But the tendency then of revivalism is to suggest that it is essential for the Christian to flee from the city and to find then the value of his life by transcending his culture, so that it does not have any claims upon him, nor is he particularly responsible for it. This was articulated in a rather surprising way to me by Dwight L. Moody, who, when he was asked about social conditions and was asked to be a leader in social movements, especially, for example, say someone who was an alcoholic or a rapist or a robber, and what could he do for his brother? Immediately it comes to mind the Cain and Abel story that we looked at somewhat earlier in the week. Dwight L. Moody's comment was, "A drunkard is not my brother. A rapist is not my brother. My brother is only one who has had a conversion experience as I have." He described his terms of brotherhood then in a spiritual sense. Only those who had the same religious view are my brothers. Therefore, he said, we need less and less of social amelioration, and we need more and more of repentance. That's where the Christian finds his brotherhood, within the saved, not with humanity in general. And then another point of view that I think that also segregates what I'll be doing with what we have been hearing earlier this morning is that, and I alluded to this briefly yesterday, again, it's particularly true with Dwight L. Moody, who's the major revival figure after the Civil War, that the revived Christians often have with them the mentality that is rural-oriented or small-town-dominated. And that Moody, while he recognized, unlike his Protestant brethren of the day, that the city will determine the character of the nation, yet what Moody sought to do was to steal the character of the young men and women who moved to the city so that they would not be corrupted by the city, but that in the urban environment they could preserve their rural small-town values. And this is what seems to me to dominate so much of Protestant thinking, that its outlook towards culture and society is basically small town and rural. And what revivalism has essentially sought to do, and perhaps we can say even to the present time, is to preserve an increasingly urbanized, industrialized America, the rural small town values of the early 19th century. And in that way, to avoid many of the problems to which those who are interested in the social gospel are seeking to address. Also today, when I'm talking about revivalism, I am able to include every religious denomination in this country, because every denomination has revivalistic traits. Even Lutheranism has a form of revivalism in it that we'll be getting to. And to a certain extent, I imagine there are times when Holden itself is revivalistic. So that we all are a part then of this. Then also a further statement is that if one wants to look at something that is rather indeed distinctive about the American religious scene as opposed to the European religious scene, we may look at the phenomenon of revivalism. It is not that it isn't present other places in the world, but it is present to a far greater degree on the American scene. It is one of the contributions that America has made to world Christianity. Now, I'm going to suggest that revivalism is essentially a technique. And it becomes more than a technique. The closer we come to our own day, it becomes an entire system of religion. Starts out as a technique, eventually becomes an entire system of religion. Now, in looking at revivalism, I would like to point out various stages. The first basic movement of revivalism in this country occurred before the American Revolution, beginning in the 1720s and lasting somewhere in the colonies to the outbreak of the Revolution in the 1770s. This revival has been called the Great Awakening. But I would like to zero in on just one figure as representative of the more lasting effects of the Great Revival. There were many who appeared and disappeared rather quickly, but the one who had a lasting impression was a fellow by the name of Jonathan Edwards. A very precocious lad, graduated from Yale College at a very early age, and then went to live with his grandfather in Northampton, Massachusetts. His grandfather was Solomon Stoddard, who for 40 years was the pastor of the largest parish in New England outside of Boston. And Solomon Stoddard, over those four decades, came to be viewed as the Pope of the Connecticut River Valley, the dominant figure. And Solomon Stoddard had an idea on religion in which he sought to emphasize the emotional side of religion. And he did it in a way in which I think we as Lutherans can understand. In Northampton, the practice was, and this was general throughout New England, that the Holy Communion, and of course they didn't use those terms, it was not a sacrament for them, for the Puritans, it was more of an ordinance, the ordinance of the Lord's table, that was reserved only for those who had proved to the community that they were indeed the elect of God. Only proven saints. In other words, it was the feast of the saints, but with this modifier, it was the feast of the proven saints. And so, in order to commune, one had to have a religious experience in which he or she felt certain that God had called them. And then they had to relate this experience before the entire congregation, and then the congregation would vote whether the experience was legitimate or not. And in this way, they identified the full church members on the basis of experience. Now, Solomon Stoddard backed off of this. He said it's very difficult for individuals to have experience, that is, some individuals. And then it's even more difficult when you've had an experience, and you may have a few questions about it, to be able to get up before a congregation and relate it, and then to have them sit and pass judgment upon it. So what Solomon Stoddard said is that everyone who lives a moral life, a decent life, who is a good citizen in the community, ought to be permitted to come to the Lord's Supper. Because, Stoddard argued, the Lord's Supper itself is possessed of such religious intensity that it may indeed be a converting ordinance. And it may be, in these Puritans then, the sacrament of grace, in the sense that you, by participating in the Lord's Supper, become aware of God's presence in your life. Now, when Solomon Stoddard finally died, Jonathan Edwards succeeded him. And Edwards had no sympathy with that kind of institutional conveyance of grace. And Edwards went back to the old Calvinist line and argued that no one may present themselves at the Lord's table unless they have prior had that experience that has been authenticated by the parish. Edwards then moved the conveyance of grace from the table back to the pulpit. And carrying on the prior Puritan tradition, Edwards would preach to his people. And he was not a charismatic speaker at all. And he was a physical shrimp with a very high-pitched voice, poor eyesight, and so he read his sermons for an hour at a time. But this was Edwards' idea, and it goes back to the Puritan idea, that more than likely, if one ever becomes aware that he has indeed been chosen by God for salvation, that will occur while he listens to the word of God being explicated. Now, we hear quite a bit here at Holden. We never hear about the preacher. We never hear about a sermon. But we hear about the proclamation and the proclaimer. And I think Edwards was picking up on those terms. That it's the word of God which is empowered by the Spirit when it is articulated, when it is proclaimed by a proclaimer. And so he developed then, not the sacrament of the altar, that essentially we rejected, but he developed what has become dominant in American religious life, the sacrament of the pulpit. And that is really very much a pew sacrament in this country, the sacrament of the pulpit. It is through the preaching that one is moved by the Spirit of God. Now, Edwards, as I have suggested for you in a few moments ago, in a very dull way, it would seem, in our age of mass communication techniques, got up and just delivered these sermons on the love of God. And in 1734 and 35, in the winter of that year, he was amazed at the number of people who were affected by his preaching and who came forward to relate to the congregation that they had had the experience of God's presence. Some 300 individuals became communicant members of the church during that winter in Northampton. It was a revival. It was cut short, however, when one of the local businessmen, in a fit of religious ecstasy, slit his own throat and died. Quickly ended the revival. But then Edwards began to reflect back on it, and he wrote the story of it in two volumes. One was called Religious Affections, and the other one, the one that I prefer, A Surprising Narrative of the Things That Have Happened Amongst Us by the Spirit of the Lord. This was Edwards' concept of a revival. It is a miracle. It is the means by which God identifies those who are of the elect. A revival is a miracle. One preaches, one has no idea that anyone will respond. One doesn't really even expect anyone to respond. If one does, it is the working of the Spirit of God. Now that is how revivalism begins in this country. but it is no longer established, then that theological idea is dropped. Because after the Great Awakening expired, partially because it had run its course of time, but perhaps more importantly, all attention was centered on the Revolution. It was after the Revolution that the Second Great Awakening occurred. And this was initially in Connecticut at Yale College. The sons of those sturdy, conservative Connecticut farmers going off to Little Yale College to get their education were not learning what their teachers were saying, but they were infatuated with the latest reports that came across the Atlantic of what was going on in the French Revolution. And college boys went behind the haystacks to do things that they could not do out in public. That is, name each other Robespierre, Voltaire, and identify in this way with the French Revolution, which their fathers, and this developed the whole idea about French civilization that Mark Twain used to like to satirize. If you call someone French, even today, I tried this out on the college students, if you were called French, what would this signify? And they often smile, say it, and then I say, well, does it indeed signify that perhaps you're a little immoral? Does it perhaps imply you're a little anarchic? And as far as the Connecticut Revolution and the Connecticut farmers were concerned, it certainly referred to the fact that you're an atheist. That is, the French Revolution was not well received by the Americans who had just gone through their own conservative reformation. And so the president of Yale and the preacher of the church in town said, we've got to do something about these boys. And what we're going to do is this. We're going to make them go to chapel every day. Every day. And we're going to bomb away at what is the good life. And what is the good life is the Christian culture of Connecticut. And if we keep pouring this into it, if we keep pounding away, we know that these boys, given their background, will eventually come to understand and they'll outgrow this infatuation. If we do it right, if we do it long enough, we know we'll get the results. Now that's the Second Great Awakening. You see, it really is a technique now. It's a manipulative technique. Know your audience, know your message, and then contrive a way to communicate that message, and you will convert them. And this is the idea, to a large extent, that has dominated revivalism ever since in America. A revival is not a miracle in which the grace of God comes to the elect. The revival is a technique by which you do secure, scientifically, you want to say psychology is a science, scientifically, a desired goal. But at the same time that this was developing, about in the late 1790s in Connecticut, we have another form of the Second Great Awakening that emerges in the frontier in the Kentucky wilderness and becomes that phenomenon known as the camp meeting. Now, camp meeting religion is basically a form of Christian presentation that one can trace during the first generation of settlement all the way from Kentucky to the Pacific coast. Yet it has no place in chronological time in American history. It does have a place in settlement history, the first generation. Now I could tell you about the one in Kentucky. But I want to read you just a brief paragraph that I came across in my researches on Protestantism in Frontier, Montana, of a camp meeting occurring in 1910 in the Rockies of western Montana, and it is identical to what you could have read about 100 years earlier in the frontier of Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio. And here it is. This is 1910 in Montana, and it's a lady who's writing in her diary. Folk would come in their covered wagons with a cow tied to the back of the wagon. bring bedding for the family and grub for themselves and others who might be eating with them. Of course, everything was very primitive. All the preachers would try to be there as many days as they could stay. It was an occasion to be looked forward to and planned many weeks before, and possibly remembered the rest of their life, for many were converted. Now, as I take a look in some detail at the camp meeting, I'd like to suggest that whereas there perhaps are not many camp meetings as such today in which denominations invite the whole families to come, there are still a lot of Bible camps in which impressionable teenagers are approached through this very same methodology of the camp meeting. Now, and Lutheranism also participates in this form. Now, what the camp meeting called for was that in the slack season for the frontier farmer, who in a sparsely settled area suffered intensely from lonesomeness, that a clearing would be made in the forest or in the mountains, and the families would be invited for an annual social event. As one historian for this says, this is the precursor for what is so typical in much of rural America today, the county fair. It is the social moment where everybody gets together in a slack season, only this time it's done under the organizational aegis of religion. They would come together, pitch their tents in the typical round fashion, making a big circle with their wagons or their tents or their arbors, however they made their shelter, in the midst of which they would erect a preaching stand and put down some simple log pews, men on one side and women on the other side, and have preaching at 10 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and 7 o'clock at night. And as they had this preaching, it was interspersed then with meals and coffee breaks. And since these people were dreadfully lonely and they got together and this was their one real, truly social occasion of magnitude other than a cabin raising or a barn raising, they would get together here and there would be virtually no time for sleeping. And after about the third or fourth day, they would bring on the best preacher, that is, the spellbinder, who by torchlight all the way around this circle in darkness of night would mount that speaker stand and would flay away at the judgment of sin. Would flay away at the judgment of sin. To people who were physically exhausted, emotionally excited, perhaps a little psychologically warped. Then after he had portrayed glowingly the pit of hell, and you remember, you're watching these flares all the way around you, and you were reminded of all the sins that you had committed in the last 12 months, he would then quickly shift and start talking about Beulah Land and the glories of heaven and peace and comfort. And when he got going on this theme, after having dragged everyone through the sulfuric pit, there would be Methodist exhorters all the way around, the cheerleaders, who would encourage you to repent and respond to the preacher. Now, with people as exhausted as they were, they responded, and the preacher knew they would respond, and the exhorter knew they would respond, and this whole thing was manipulative. And these people would respond. And they would respond in their frontier crudity with physical reactions, such as getting on the ground and rolling, getting the jerks so that their limbs flipped, especially women with long hair, getting that hair just like a whip back of their necks, getting down and going over to a tree and seeing the devil that had been exorcised from there sitting on a limb and then barking at it like a dog. Dancing exercises. People might even become unconscious as they released all of their emotions. And in this way, they were converted. This intense emotional experience. but so very carefully programmed. Now, some of you may be acquainted with Bible camps in which perhaps on a little more sophisticated level the same thing is done. Have a campfire, after you sing a few hymns, then pull from the impressionable teenagers testimonies. But make sure that the testimonies you pull first are of sin. How bad I have been. And after you've pulled all this out, then turn it to the positive side and talk about Christian experience. Now you do this not the first night, but the third, the fourth, and the fifth night. Just like when you watch a Billy Graham crusade on TV, it's always the last three nights of a two-week crusade when everything has been built up and the people come streaming out of the bleachers. It's not the first two or three nights when you're setting the stage. It's at the end of the revival doing this. The problem with this camp meeting thing was that people caught religion, also quickly lost it. Now, sometimes individual lives were indeed permanently changed, and they became plugged into a local Christian congregation. But many times there either was no local congregation to plug in, or they woke up the next morning with a spiritual hangover and tried the next few days to get over it and vowed, "I'll never let that happen to me again." Until the next camp meeting came up, then everybody went back, not necessarily for the religious part, but for the social part. Now, some denominations truly sought to control this, and the Methodists became the most active in the camp meeting, and eventually about the only denomination. But the Presbyterians are there, and the Baptists were there. And they tried, in their separate ways, losing the sense of ecumenicity, to conclude the camp meeting session by having a communion service. So this whole thing then turned out to be sort of a prolonged confessional. And then you'd have the absolution in your conversion. And then you'd go off to a denominational communion service. And in this way, they hoped to be able to sort of bottle the experience and establish the contact. And then you would go home and be nurtured with your Methodist class meeting or at the Presbyterian church or with your farmer Baptist preacher, this type of thing. Well, what I'm suggesting is that the first great awakening with Jonathan Edwards, a conversion is a miracle, has basically disappeared. The idea of the second great awakening on the Connecticut side, whereby there is a goal to be achieved to inculcate, some of that still remains. And the camp meeting still does continue, perhaps more so in youth camps. But it does form an outdoor ministry thing, and if it isn't carefully watched, it can degenerate into what the frontier camp meetings did in fact become. But that the form of the revival that is the most enduring in America, and is the one in which I would say Lutheranism plugs in very consistently, was that developed in the 1820s by a man by the name of Charles Grandison Finney. Charles Finney. And it's what's called the protracted meeting. And this is what Finney had in mind. He was by training a lawyer. Of course, he didn't go to school to become a lawyer. He studied with a practicing lawyer and became a lawyer. And he was very confused about the multiplicity of the religious options. So like Joe Smith, at about the same time, same proximate area of the country, upstate New York, Finney went out to wrestle with God for a night. And while he was out there, Finney became convinced that religion was a matter of one's relationship to Jesus Christ, not a matter of denominational affiliation. He had an experience of Christ out in the woods. He came back to his law office the next morning and greeted the first client who came in with the rather abrupt statement, "I have received from a retainer from the Lord Jesus Christ. I do not have time to plead your cause." Finney went into preaching, but he preached like a lawyer. And this is what he did with a protracted meeting. He brought it into the small towns of America, where it became a permanent thread in the fabric of American religion. And when he brought it into the small towns of America, that is, means also that he brought it into the little congregational churches, where you would have a small group of people, and a people with a more settled way of life than the frontiersmen who came to the camp meeting. And he would establish a series of meetings in which you'd bring in an evangelist who would preach on Sunday morning, and then Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, and Thursday night. And he would preach, and this is what Finney did, in a medium that would convey. He said, you must always be relevant. He wasn't so concerned that he'd be reverent. But he would speak to that small group of people within that holy building, night after night after night, like, as he said, a lawyer addressing the jury. So that any reasonable person, not emotional now, like the camp meeting, any reasonable person, by the end of the week, would have to vote in favor of the client of the preacher. In other words, what Finney was saying is that you may persuade through a series of evening meetings using relevant language all reasonable people that what Jesus Christ represents is a higher plane of living than you are currently pursuing. Now, this had really no theology as such, nor was it denominational as such, but it was calling small town, settled, more likely conservative people, to a higher plane of living. Now, did this convert people, or was this essentially a pep rally of those who already wanted the team to win? And there you now begin to see revivalism in the protracted meeting going away from a converting ordinance and mechanism to a nurturing mechanism. That Christians who listen to the same preacher 52 Sundays of the year begin to recognize that he does run out of steam. And they run out of steam before he does, perhaps. So you need this energizing from time to time. So you bring in the evangelists who is going to deepen your Christianity or raise your level of Christian living. But it's essentially an in-house methodology, a technique. Now that has always plagued revivalism. I mean, the term itself, revive, suggest there's already something there that you're igniting again. And yet when we use the term revivalism, I think in probably in common parlance, we are really talking more about recruitment. Well, I'm suggesting that probably a majority of the congregations, taking all denominations into consideration, in small town, rural America, and even in middle city America, will sometime during the year have a protracted meeting. And they may very well use it as a recruitment technique, but they may also use it as a spiritual life emphasis week for internal deepening. Even Roman Catholics do this. They have their novenas. They'll have their week. Episcopalians will bring in some kind of a spiritual director for a week. Lutherans will do this. In fact, I can remember some years ago, and certainly in the old ELC and in their first years of the ALC, there was a professional evangelist whose very assignment in ministry was to do this, to go around to congregation and conducted what in a sense, in essence, is a protracted meeting. And certainly, and you find this in Congregational and Presbyterians, Methodists are great on these kind of witnessing sessions. This is the dominant form of revivalism in America today. And it has been with us now for 150 years. The protracted meeting. Partially as recoupment, partially as renewal. But lumped together, really, as a form of revivalism. Well, after this, the 1820s, and all of these that I've mentioned so far have a clergyman at the apex. These are clergy directed. All of these are. But we come to another form of revivalism in which there is no clergy direction, and which is having a heyday on the American scene today. And that is a response by concerned Christians to the financial panic of 1857. Now, sometimes financial panic and war bring about religiosity. Sometimes they don't. But in 1857, it brought about a wave of religiosity that took the form of the noontime prayer meeting. Today, it's the breakfast meeting or the Christian Women's Club or something of this nature, wherein individuals will meet on a regular basis, perhaps weekly, brown bag it, if it's at noon, have their ham and eggs together, if it's at breakfast, and they will witness to one another as to what Christianity means to them. It is not an explication of theology, and it is not denominational. I have gone to some of these Christian Women's Club ones. There were two things you could not discuss at this, which was supposed to be a spiritual gathering. Two things you could not discuss. Number one, you could not talk about your pastor. You couldn't vent all of your emotions about your pastor there. That was outside the bonds, and you couldn't talk about your church. You could only talk about your faith. It was a sharing moment, non-denominational, but intensely religious. It's piety. And you look across the scene today, you have all kinds of these. Businessmen's clubs, these meetings. A form of revivalism that emerged in this country in 1857 and has always remained a part of us, part of the scene. The lay organized, lay oriented, witnessing, usually in connection with a meal, but done on a regular basis. That was in 1857. The next basic form of revivalism, and I presume it's the one that enjoys the image of what revivalism in America is today, emerged after the Civil War, initially centered on the figure of Dwight L. Moody, when I simply call it the Urban Campaign, of which, of course, Billy Graham is the present developer, that is, major developer. Dwight L. Moody, the story is in itself a very interesting one. He was a success in business, enormously successful man in business, but he set it all aside in order to become a revivalist. Now, Moody, during the Civil War, was part of a Christian commission that went to talk to the injured in the Civil War. And when he did this, he came to the conclusion that a lot of the men who were dying, and just the other day we referred to this as the bloodiest war in our history, a lot of the men were dying, and they weren't ready to die. And what this impressed upon Moody is that one must always be ready. And so Moody introduced into revivalism the element that the first question that you indeed ask is that stereotype. Are you saved? You begin with that question. This is the one all-important question of life. Now, how do you develop a means by which you can raise this question? If we look at Moody, his story is extremely interesting because he never did develop a theology. That is, in his own mind, he never developed a theology. And his idea of conversion is not at all which we normally associate with a revivalist. He left the farm when he was a 17-year-old lad, went to work in Boston. No one would give him a job, except he prevailed upon an uncle who ran a shoe store to take him in. The uncle didn't want him because he thought he was an awful free-spirited kid. The uncle says, I'll take you into this shoe store if you don't embarrass me. And what I mean by not embarrassing me is I mean that you have to go to church every Sunday morning. You have to go to Sunday school, and then you have to go to church. And also you've got to be in by 10 o'clock every night. And Moody, desperate, agreed. So he went to church, slept through every sermon. He liked Sunday school better because you could talk there. But one day, as he was wrapping shoes in the back of the store, his teacher came and visited with him. Now, Moody's father had died when Moody was extremely young. He had no recollection of his father, only that of a very loving maternal mother. But here this man comes in and talks to Dwight L. Moody, and in very simple language says, Jesus loves you and wishes you to love him. And as he was wrapping shoes in the back of the store, with that simple testimony of this lay Sunday school teacher, Dwight L. Moody was converted. All there was to it. And now this is what Moody writes in his diary the next morning as he leaves the home to go to the shoe store. And this is his view of life. And as we walk the trails here at Holden, see if we do have a bit of the Moody in us. I remember the morning on which I came out of my room after I had first trusted Christ. I thought the old sun shone a good deal brighter than it ever had before. He's walking across Boston Common now, as he reflects here. I thought that it was just smiling upon me. And as I walked out upon Boston Common and heard birds singing in the trees, I thought they were all singing a song to me. Do you know, I fell in love with the birds. I had never cared for them before. It seemed to me that I was in love with all creation. I had not a bitter feeling against any man, and I was ready to take all men to my heart. If a man has not the love of God shed abroad in his heart, he has never been regenerated. Now that's his Christian testimony. And this is what he said about a revival. And he was a master in organizing them. He was a businessman. And they were well-oiled campaigns, just like you can watch Billy Graham on TV now. The only thing that Graham has really added is mass media. But this is what Moody said about a revival. No one is ever converted, or rarely so, in a mass meeting. All the mass meeting does is set the mood. The conversion takes place when the person leaves the mass meeting and goes to the inquiry room. And there in the inquiry room, he meets a mature Christian. And in a one-on-one basis, that mature Christian leads this individual who is now in the mood of religious interest to read the Bible. And the mature Christian must exercise tremendous sensitivity and human understanding in suggesting at the right moment that the two pray together. And if the right moment is selected when they pray together, that is when that inquirer will feel the touch of God on his heart. It is not for the mature Christian to tell the inquirer what Christianity is, because he is not interested in another man's experience. He is interested only in his own. And the mature Christian cannot tell the inquirer, you are now a Christian. Only the individual will know whether or not he has been touched by the life, by the Spirit of God. In Moody, in spite of the mass campaigning, you have one, I think, of the most profound examples of Christian individualism. Only you will know. And it occurs only in a one-on-one. What's the meaning, then, of a mass campaign? It is to get people together and to provide the mood. Now, I don't know how you think of that with regard to a Billy Graham campaign. Is it really a mass psychology? Moody fought that consistently. It is an intensely personal moment. But what did he do in his campaigns? Well, who would Moody speak to? Well, he said, I have come to raise the life of Christianity in this city. I have not really come to convert the sinners. Moody recognized that his campaigns were pep rallies. But who was he seeking to rally? Moody never forgot what happened to him when he left Northfield, Massachusetts and went off to Boston. It was that Sunday school teacher who sought him out in the shoe store. Dwight L. Moody says, I'm going out to have this huge Sunday school class. And then I'm going to have all these teachers in the after rooms. And so he went after, and ideally he went after himself. He relived his life in his campaigns. He sought to address the young men and women who had come into the cities. Moody died in 1899, who had come into the cities after the Civil War to seek their fortune. And there to remind them of the good life they had left behind. And to strengthen them in those values so that they would be steeled against the corroding influence of the urban life. In one of the hymns that he had his associate, Ira Sankey, sing before he would preach is this one. I find it here now. And I think it kind of sums it all up. Moody recognized the importance of music, and of course it's really from Moody and Ira D. Sankey that the gospel song comes, which is not a denominational hymn book. It was not intended to be used in church. How often we sometimes forget that today, that different forms of hymnody have different purposes. And Moody said that my hymns are not for churches, therefore my rallies. They are distinctly mood setting. They are not vehicles of worship. And here's one he'd have Ira Sankey sing as he prepared to address then what he thought would be a congregation of young people who, if they didn't watch their traditions, would be destroyed by the city. Where is my wandering boy tonight? The boy of my tenderest care, the boy that was once my joy and light, the child of my love and prayer. Once he was pure as morning dew, as he knelt at his mother's knee. No face was so bright, no heart more true, and none was so sweet as he. Oh, could I see you now, my boy, as fair as in olden time, when prattle and smile made a home of joy, and life was a merry chime. Go for my wandering boy tonight. Go search for him where you will, but bring him to me with all his blight, and tell him I love him still. And then between each stanza was this chorus. Oh, where is my boy tonight? Oh, where is my boy tonight? My heart o'erflows, for I love him, he knows. Oh, where is my boy tonight? And then Moody could respond to Mother Dear. He's right here in the arena. He is not lost. He will be strengthened in what you taught him. he will persevere in this awful city. But he needs, what he needs is a mature Christian to look after him. And I have those available. This is how his Christianity will be strengthened. Now, Moody was at the forefront of nearly every Protestant endeavor in the last quarter of the 19th century. He was the main mover behind the Sunday schools. He was the main mover behind Bible institutes. And the one organization that was perhaps his pride and joy, in which really reflects what a Moody revival is all about, is the YMCA. That was a Moody institution in this country. And what was the purpose of the Y, as Moody articulated it? It is for the Christian man to go down to the bus depot, go down to the rail station, to welcome the young stranger as he comes into the city, to put his arms around him, to find a place for him to live, to see to it that he gets good food, and to bring him to the rooms of the association where he may be nurtured in the faith. And then later was added the athletic program, which now seemingly dominates the Y, kind of a physical culture family club. But initially, it was a form of religious nurture, and Moody pushed it. Well, Walter Rauschenbusch, the social gospel advocate, could speak oftentimes very positively about Rydell Moody. He deplored the fact that Moody had such a negative social consciousness in terms of change. But he applauded Moody's intense interest in the individual. At the end of the century, there came to be the showman of revivalism, the flamboyant Iowa farm boy, Billy Sunday. Now, Billy Sunday stated, like Charles Finney, you've got to be relevant even if you're not reverent. Moody was always reverent. Billy Sunday made the comment in 1910, this is the age of the circus, and the crowd goes where the best three wings are. And so his revivals provided the best circus in town. And he was the chief clown. He made revivalism vaudeville. And it gave it a certain characteristic, perhaps exposed best of all by Elmer Gantry, the novel, Sinclair Lewis's Elmer Gantry, or the portrayal in the film for which Burt Lancaster won the Oscar for Best Actor of the Year some time ago, portraying Elmer Gantry. And this has given revivalism another name and another image. Billy Sunday is not adequately portrayed in Elmer Gantry. But Billy Sunday did believe that showmanship was very, very important. Unfortunately, all that Billy Sunday had to portray as gospel, all he could proclaim, was negatives. He hated Germans. And he said unhesitatingly, if you lift Germany off the map and look at the, now if you lift hell off the map and look at the bottom, you will see made in Germany inscribed on the bottom. Yeah. But from 1910 to 1920, that was very popular. And the second major thing that he was against was booze. And his best sermon was always his booze sermon. Well, 1918, we had prohibition, and he wrote that. So what ridicule you may bestow upon Billy Sunday, the fact of the matter is that as long as he stayed in the small towns of the Corn Belt, he more than doubled the church membership when he left town, and that doubling never diminished. He was an effective institutional propagandist in the Corn Belt towns. But when he got to the cities and he really put on his shows, his impact was very, very little. Now, my teacher at the University of Chicago simply sums up Billy Graham by saying, "It's Billy Sunday in a tuxedo." And I don't know if you saw the analysis of the Seattle campaign that Billy had a couple of years ago. It's now been thoroughly analyzed. And the results of the Graham Crusade show that after a 12-month period, there virtually is no change. Virtually no change 12 months later. Though during that first 12 months, there was a slight increase in Seattle church attendance. But that is so contemporary that historians like myself don't want to deal with those who are living. I'll let you analyze Billy Graham. But this is all the precursor to it, and he does, Billy Graham, as I see him at least, continues in the tradition that you have, not really of Billy Sunday, I think that's unfair, more in the tradition of Dwight L. Moody, more in the Moody tradition. But this has become now not just a technique, I argue, but for many it is a system of religion in this country that is alongside denominationalism, almost institutionalized alongside of denominationalism, but is a form of piety that is part of the general mix, which includes the gospel of wealth and the social gospel. And that is revivalism, perhaps the distinctive contribution that America has made to the religious worldwide Christian scene. That's what I have to say on it. If you like to raise some comments, you come from a good Lutheran background, you can raise the question that was always raised and by the German Lutherans in Pennsylvania and the German Reformed in Pennsylvania that would raise these in the 19th century. You have essentially the way of the catechism and the way of the revival. And you can really get into a long discussion on that one, get Horace Bushnell in on this with his Christian Nurture. And a revivalist seemingly starts that you're a miserable sinner, you've got to be reconstructed. The way of the catechism suggests, well, yes, you are a sinner, but you will find your reconstruction in the tradition. Now, is it the way of the catechism or is it the way of the revival? Denominations split on this. If you want to look at the denominations, have trouble with it, which is a little bit like taking a look at the 20th century Lutheran Church Missouri Synod thing, is to take a look at the Presbyterian Church, where they had 5/9 extending 4/9 on much of the same question, of this kind of a question, the way of the catechism or the way of the revival. And you had a denominational situation where just over 50% kicked out the 45%. But in that particular story, they got back together again on the revivalist side. So you have these.
Some of the things you said both yesterday and today have led me to wonder whether it would be legitimate to think of revivalism as a primarily technique, as you said, resting on many of the same assumptions that social gospel rested on. And it seems to me, at least, as you said yesterday, that the social gospel, as formulated by Rauschenbusch, really was talking about a pre-industrial ideal community with the values of the family and home and heart and this sort of thing. And that the world was a contaminant, and what you needed to do was face up to some of those things.
Using last week, in that the revivalists are essentially, and the social gospelers as we were looking at them yesterday, primitivists.
They are
in that sense, they are primitivists.
In some sense, would you think that most of the forms of piety that you've been talking about are primitivistic?
The forms of piety that I've been talking about here are American forms of piety, and it seems to me that they are primitivistic because, as I have suggested several times, that seems to me that the American Protestant community is pre-industrial and pre-urban. That its basic outlooks go back, and that you have this romanticism. You still have this romanticism that the Indian, he's that noble creation of God living in the pure wilderness. Let us go back there.
Is that what you meant last week? I mean, I wasn't here last week, but did you mean by primitivism pre-industrial?
Basically, it's pre-industrial. That's not exactly the category I use. What I mean by primitivism is that you have the opportunity in America to shed the cultural accretions of the centuries and out here in this Garden of Eden recreate what Adam blew. And you do it with the simple word of God, all of the Bible, as in the English Puritan tradition, it is interpreted by the Spirit directly to you. So it is an idealization, a sort of a romantic quality.
Of course, the only evangelist that I've had any connection with is Billy Graham. Any experience, personal experience with. But it seems that so often we think of numbers of people that are really converted and converted forever, not just a momentary conversion. And I've been led to believe that Billy Graham and his team, they understand this, but the main thing is that God really rejoices when one person is saved, is converted. So it isn't the numbers, and I'm sure that probably with Moody or Sunday or Billy Graham or whoever, that whatever their endeavors are, there are people that really have been touched. I know this in experience with the Emmanuel Lutheran Church in North Hollywood after the 1950 crusade at the Hollywood Bowl. And I could, although I didn't go down at the time, I mean, to reaffirm my faith or anything like that, yet I saw these people go down. I was singing in the choir. And I noticed a great difference in them and their zeal for helping at the church and helping people. Well, and that really made a very, very strong belief in my mind that this type of evangelism was good.
Well, I'll respond several ways to that very quickly. One is that in suggesting that Graham is more like Moody, then you get back that it's the individualism, the individual that really matters, not the mass, the individual. And also with Graham, as with Moody, and somewhat with Sunday and on the others, they're there and they leave, but it's the resident congregations that really carry on the work. It's not over with when the revival is over. It's the congregations that are to carry it on. And then the other thing that I would respond to this numbers game, as you rightly point out. Marty made this comment once in a lecture that has always stuck with me. He said, anyone who went to the seminary in the 50s, like I did, or the very, very early 60s, went in an age of religiosity in this country, and their seminary training was always colored that success was determined by numbers. And he said, now you take a lot of clergymen who are 45 to 50 are now coming to some of the parishes where they're going to be able to extend the most physical energy, and they're hung up because they went through a seminary education that bigness marks success, and they're having a little trouble with the 70s. And I think I fall into that trouble, because I graduated from college in the year in which statistics say that college students went to church in the greatest numbers they've ever gone in American history. And that was the college student of 1955. That was when college church attendance peaked across this country. And then you go to the seminary and the religiosity was there, and you played this numbers game, and you were trained almost to play this numbers game. If not consciously, at least unconsciously, this is what happened to you. And it's a different game that you're playing in the 70s, in that game. But I think you're right to point out that I'm not so sure that one could say that Billy Sunday just didn't count noses, but not Dwight L. Moody. Not Dwight L. Moody. You were suggesting that the form of revivalism was more a form of renewal than conversion. I'm just wondering how you would look at the contemplative retreat, especially in the Catholic tradition. Would that be also a form of revivalism? Could that be also a newer form of revivalism?
I think there are many forms of that revivalism. I'm basically suggesting this one line that seems to be on a continuum,
but the more popular,
but there are certain other forms of renewal. But there's always a tension, whether it's recruitment or renewal, whether it's conversion or enrichment.
Would you make a distinction then between renewal and revivalism?
It's very hard to, I think, because the preacher has to keep both in mind, because you have both types of people there. I think it's hard to separate them out.
A comment about Billy Graham. In the San Francisco Crusade of 58, I was on the executive committee, and I was assistant chairman of the Seattle Crusade. And one of the things I think we have to remember is that in the Seattle area, one of the reasons a lot of us worked for the opportunity of this experience was a sense of defeatism within the church, a sense of a lack of optimism, and an awareness that this kind of an experience is positive within the people in the parishes. And a lot of us in conversations with Graham have suggested to him that one of the biggest values of a crusade is the encouragement to the congregations and to their membership. And this is the thing that you picked up. People who get, you know, tired, weary, and well-doing get a kind of lift, and they go back into their parishes with a new enthusiasm. And one of the things that happened within the Seattle area is a sense of buoyancy and a sense of hopefulness, and also a climate of cooperation within the community. The parishes that previously had not had much knowledge of each other, much acquaintanceship, no ties of friendship, working together within this experience became acquainted, and it left a climate of cordiality and goodwill, which may be one of the best legacies of an experience like this. The other thing I want to point out is that Graham's emphasis, unlike some of the others, has never presented to the person who comes forward that instant salvation is an eternal possession, but that it is the struggling. And very often, and this is quite different than previous affirmations, your problems will not be over. Some of your problems will be beginning as you begin the Christian life. The second thing is, he ties them into Bible study groups. They utilize the Navigator's memorization theory, and they always really strive to relate them to a congregation. What I'm trying to point out is that you have different strands in an emphasis like today's Grand Crusade. I think if you keep these in mind, we won't be quite as unfair as very often we are when we evaluate the results of the crusade. Okay.
I think some of them, there's a Nurtabell, but some who come from the Midwest and settle on the West Coast sort of have this idea of defeatism that you suggested. I remember my wife's cousin lives in Northern California, says, "Say, see all that white stuff on the mountains? That's not snow. That's church transfers that never made it."